Quinn, I've been reading up a damn storm.
What you been reading?
I've been reading a thing called Sirens and Muses. I went to the Center for Fiction in Brooklyn, and it was recommended. Like, I do like going to a bookstore is such a challenge. They say don't judge a book by its cover.
What do you mean?
That's all you're gonna do. Like,
oh, you
picking
mean
out a
going
book to
in
read.
Blind? I don't know if I'd ever go into a bookstore and just blindly select.
Really?
Yeah.
People do it.
I have lists.
All
I have
the time.
Lists, and they're like written on pieces of paper that I crumble up and stick in drawers that I never open or put in jackets and then don't wear the jacket for 2 years. It's, yeah.
That's a fun thing you do to yourself.
Yeah, I make
a
lot of lists
to yourself.
Yeah.
You do two to yourself.
I am in the middle of three books. And
I don't think I can do that.
Let me be clear. I've been in the middle of these three books for, I don't know, maybe 3 years. I bounce around. I forget what's going on. I begin them again. My relationship with these books is getting more serious than I ever wanted it to. They're not particularly great books.
What if you just move on? What if you break up with them and find another book?
I feel like I've come so far, I just need to complete one of them. Maybe what I need to do is decide who. I wish there was a reality game show for this kind of thing where I could like eliminate books.
I did something really tacky. I left the train. The train went express. Annoying. But I got off at the stop after yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked and I read while I walked.
Oh, that does sound crazy.
It's really crazy, but I was like, oh, I want to know
on
what's happening.
On your iPad?
On my phone.
It's like to put you on the iPad walking.
Little town, it's quiet village. I just look like Belle on my iPad with my light lit
blonde
up.
Belle?
Blonde All right, Belle.
You're really
blonde
selling Belle. This reading thing.
Thank
what
you so
else
much.
Have you been doing besides reading this week?
This week? Oh my God, great question. What have I been doing? Oh, Friday was a fun day for me. I did like a workshop reading of the show that I was workshopping last week.
The Witches Show.
The Witches Show, which was so fun. I don't know if you've ever been, if you ever get an opportunity to read a play that someone funny that you like wrote,
mm-hmm.
you should do it. It is so fun. And also to be in a room with funny people and to talk script, like it's such a luxury. It's like you take it for granted. I know when I would do shows in college, we would spend a lot of time doing table reads where mm-hmm. you'd sit around and talk about the script ad nauseum. And sometimes mm-hmm. it was like so annoying.
Mm-hmm.
When you're workshopping a new script, that's just what you do. You sit around, you talk about what could be fixed, what could change, your thoughts, your opinions. You take really big swings because you're just reading the text from, you know, from a page.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very fun luxury to have for
yeah,
a week.
Definitely.
And it's just like talking to smart, funny people, laughing, trying really silly things in the room is just really
God,
fun.
Carrie, between recommendations to read and laugh and live love, I just want to like knit this on a pillow so I don't forget it.
I know. Let's gather around. I just said it was really fun. I think
yeah.
too, it's like, I obviously, we do this podcast, which is soy fun, and I have my show, which is also soy fun, but it's also something that we are in charge of, right? Like, the only reason it gets done is because we are the arbiters of it. We are producing this. We are editing it. We are telling the stories. What was really fun is to be in a room where I took the back seat.
Oh, totally.
Do you know what I mean?
I can get why
like,
that
I
would
be
really
be
fun
a room
to be
someone,
a cog in a wheel.
I didn't have to read the script before. I just was sent a script, and I read it. With low, like I just got to be funny.
That's really fun.
It was a luxury for sure. It was a luxury for sure. You had a big week because we tested out your dinner show, which was so fun.
Which was fun. I felt like that went really well.
It went really
I wrote,
well.
Dear Readers, I wrote a new show for Purple Crayon that's like a show that you would be at a restaurant with your family or friends or a corporate event, and you would want to add puzzling to the event. So in two acts, this character would come and be under the guise of testing you out for a secret society, would play you through a series of puzzles. And it went really well. The puzzles went well. The company was hysterical.
Oh my God, the amount of jokes.
I mean,
we took a car back and like the jokes didn't stop.
Yeah, Rory and Jamie Cummings and the way they go at each other is like, we have these friends that are like, everything out of their mouth cracks
a joke.
And I have to say, Rory is so funny in this way where he's always being funny, even if no one's listening to him.
Yes.
And I know that because I'll hear him in Koa in the next room. Like, he came early and I was doing something in the kitchen. I could hear them in the living room, and Koa was showing him the gingerbread haunted house he built.
Yeah.
And I heard Rory to Koa being like, this thing does not look up to code. Like, he was just like saying,
Koa,
like,
does know that goes right over
but
Koa's
head.
He
and Koa talk forever, and Rory's like, just gems are flying out of Rory's mouth. Koa like pays them no heed. It's just really, really funny. They're like an amazing, I would love to see them do an improv,
a buddy comedy
coupling. yeah really a
weirdly
buddy comedy.
Weirdly, Koa would be the straight man.
Oh, for sure.
By the way, Koa was so excited to see me when I came in that day. That was like, I felt like a freaking
every
celebrity.
Every grown-up that came before you, he went, oh, I thought you were Carrie. And so everyone felt
it
a little sad.
Me, and then I came and he was like, it's Carrie. And I was like, it is me. And it was really fun.
Yeah.
It was really exciting.
The kids, they've really remembered their relationship with you since you came back and gotten very excited. And Carrie was playing the ukulele the other day to Griff.
Oh, my
and
God.
And he has a new toy that makes different sound effects. Applause. Farts,
booze,
all kinds of things. And he was hitting all these very disrespectful buttons during Carrie's concert. And then she started to play a song. And he like went to hit it and then just listened and said, this is a really nice song. I'm not going to hit any buttons.
There was a moment where I was playing and he was still playing along. I know, as I was playing it, all of a sudden I hear, boo. And the timing was so funny. And I know it was accidental, but it made me laugh so hard. Because all of it just, we cackled. It was so funny.
That
and
is
he kind of looked at me like, I did
giving.
A good thing. I did a good thing. I laughed.
Well, my story's really long today. So let's, without further ado, let
we
them
are
know.
Listening to Truly.
Darkly.
Creeply.
That's Carrie Ipama.
That's Quinlan Posner. And let's thank some dearest readers.
Why not? Okay, I've got some fun facts for the first one.
Yay.
We're thanking a Lindsay. We're thanking a Lindsay S. But the thing to know is that Lindsay S. is a super mom of
five
kids.
Lindsay S., five children.
From Floyd's dick. She knows what I mean.
Floyd's dick?
That's right. Floyd's dick. Lindsay knows. And Lindsay.
You got five kids.
Lindsay.
That's too many kids.
Lindsay.
How the hell are you sane?
Them?
Lindsay. Which is your favorite?
Lindsay, your last name is the same last name from the show Deadwood, and that's a clue for everybody.
Don't look her up on Facebook, but do know she has five kids, so give her all the joy in your life.
Lindsay. How about Alex G?
Alex J, I feel like a wiggle.
Alex J, do you feel like a wiggle too? Do you love wiggling, Alex G? Do you love a
wiggling,
little wiggle
do
here
you like
and
a
there?
Wiggling, Alex G? Do you like to join the Patreon to get our episodes? We love you, Alex G.
Great.
Alex G just sounded like a wiggle.
Yeah, I wasn't sure why we were doing that, but I was on board.
But don't you feel like it sounded
Alex
like...
Alex G is a wiggle?
Yeah. Like as a wiggle, like the band
Let's
The Wiggles?
A wiggle. Okay.
Yeah. No?
No, totally. What about... I mean, 1,000%. Yes, and what about... Corinne B.
Don't you want someone to... care about you.
Corinne, you're soaring straight into our hearts. Corinne, you are so floral. Like a beautiful flower that we picked from the garden.
Corinne.
Little discordant, but I think we got somewhere. In the mix. There's something salvageable there. I'm not sure what. Ashley E.
It's Ashley. Ashley, I didn't see you there.
Ashley, where are you been?
Here? Ashley.
Are you a dolphin, Ashley?
Okay. Now that we got that serious stuff out of the way, business as usual. I would love to tell you a story.
That was so unhinged.
I think there should be a rule about the singing that when we're done, we don't ever talk about what happened.
It's like Fight Club. We don't talk about it.
We just, please.
We actually can't.
Already too much that it Thank happens. You. We don't need to relive it.
Okay. Okay.
Trigger warning.
Okay.
Some stuff that has kids. So you like kids. If you have 5 kids,
if that's Quinn, that's
some stuff that has kids. Is that not going to trigger warning?
Quinn, this has some kids, some stuff about
some little kids. They die. So
okay, I can't laugh about that. But your trigger warning, was laughing.
I'm just like, I don't know how much insane. You're supposed to give away in a fucking trigger warning. Look. This is a podcast.
Listen, we do have a true crime podcast. We have a creepy podcast. If it's true, dark, and creepy, we tell the story. Here's the deal. The story that Quinn says, I don't know it, but it sounds like there's some content that is some hard things that happen to
Proceed
children.
Proceed
with caution. If that's something that makes you uncomfortable, skip to the half of the episode. Quinn will probably still be talking and then skip like 5 more minutes and then I'll start talking. Am I right?
More like 10. 1955.
Okay.
Okay, one thing I wanted to tell you is that, do you remember when you did the Grimes sisters?
Yes.
Way early in the day. That was in the first like 5 episodes we did.
From Illinois.
Well, this is the same neck of the woods in the same time frame.
This is the same kind of story.
This is that story. I'm just doing it again, but better.
Because I think you didn't do a great job. And that's fair. That's fair.
But 2 weeks before Halloween, 3 young boys, Robert Peterson, who is 13, John Schuessler, who's 13, and John's younger brother, Anton, who is 11, head to a movie called The African Lion. It's, I think, a Disney movie. Didn't do well. Never heard of it. After the movie, they stop by a bowling alley on their way home, and they leave the Monte Cristo bowling alley. They're hitchhiking is what we think is going on.
Okay, it's the 50s, different times.
Totally. And it's, I don't know, between maybe 9 and 10 at night. A woman named Hetty Salerno hears screams coming from the direction of a stable she lives near that's called the Idle Hours Stable. Now, the Idle Hours Stable is owned by a man named Silas Jane, he's like the godfather of horse mafia stuff, like a very dangerous character. And the horse mafia shit that was going down in the 50s is dark and is real, and I'll get into that soon. But just as far as geographically speaking, this stable is close to forest preserves.
It's a jelly. It's forest preserves. It pairs very well with the cheese.
Oh my god,
a salty cured meat.
Yes. How do you say that word?
I think it's preserves.
Really?
Yeah, the forest preserves.
Okay. Thank God. Because I was like, am I supposed to say like preserves? I don't. Emphasis on the wrong syllable.
No, you just can't say preserves without thinking of like a jam.
Yeah, I was like picturing. Totally. No. Okay. So what happens is 2 days later, they find the kids there and they are deceased.
Oh.
They're dead. They're naked. They'd been bound, gagged with tape. Obviously, the news is like they were sexually assaulted because they're naked. There isn't actual physical proof of anything happening. Okay. But it doesn't
it's
mean they weren't
the
sexually assaulted.
Yeah, it's also in the 50s. And
so it's confusing. Because this happens right outside Chicago, it rocks the whole town. It rocks the whole city.
Where in Chicago is this? Do you know?
It's basically near the border of the city's northwest side.
Okay, yeah.
Very close to, my understanding is it's very, very close to Evanston. Where the Grimes sisters went to the movies, who also went missing during that same general time period, and then were found also dead. Mm-hmm. These boys, everybody wanted to know what happened. Everybody's looking into what happened. There was a lot of, my understanding is that this book came out called Shattered Sense of Innocence, the 1955 murders of 3 Chicago children, that exposed why this investigation was botched and couldn't move forward, and that it was for all these different reasons that I'm not really going to get into because it's not what I want to tell the story about, and there's only so much time. But what they do talk about in this book is Richard Lindbergh, the author that wrote it, says life revolved around the parish, Little League, and bowling. Doors were unlocked. there was no urban fear of crime. There was no fear of urban crime. After the Schussler-Peterson murders, that changed. And a lot of people talk about the whole temperature changing in right. that area. And this case went unsolved for almost 40 years.
Oh, my God.
But we're just going to skip ahead about 20 years to 1977. It's a circuitous path we're going to take, but we are going to get back to these boys. There is a candy heiress named Helen Voorhees Brock.
The Brock. Yeah, the Brock, yes. B-R-A-C-H. Hello, candy
exactly,
corn. Polarizing.
Exactly. Very short history on that is that she met the founder, Frank Brock, when she was a coat check girl at a Florida country club.
It's giving me Sonia Morgan.
Totally, totally. And where's her family crest?
Mm-hmm. Couldn't agree with you more.
So Frank died in 1970. Now we're 7 years later. She's been really lonely. She doesn't really have a mission. The candy company's been sold, and she's just this wealthy widow. And the long and short of it, the facts are that she goes to an appointment at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota and is not seen by the public after that again, ever, ever, ever.
Whoa.
And that is 1977. She is declared legally dead in 1984 just because they go, that's probably the case. So 7 years go by, nothing. Let's call her dead at this point.
Whoa.
The facts surrounding her disappearance are very strange and scary. So let me start with her houseman, which, you know, it's sort of like
she's
a
rich.
Butler. Yeah. And her, I don't know, driver as well. So his name is Jack Matlick. He saw her after the Mayo Clinic appointment.
Oh.
He's the only one. He's the last to see her alive, according to him. And a bunch of her friends are trying to call her and reach her. Matlick is taking those calls and apparently giving them stories that don't match up. Sometimes the stories right. are changing when he last saw her or what she's doing. And during the course of that weekend, things we know he did are strange. He scrubbed and cleaned bunch of rooms in her
John
mansion.
Matlick?
John Matlick. He cleaned.
It's not looking good.
The maid's room. He had hit the Cadillac he drove. He had completely like washed inside out. He ordered a meat grinder attachment.
Jesus.
Meat grinding, I guess. He also cashes a bunch of checks supposedly written by her that total $13,000. But then her accountant is like, this isn't her signature. But to be clear, when a handwriting analysis person looks at it, it doesn't look like it's Matlick's signature either. Anyway, Matlick is like, well, she had really hurt her hand because she'd hit it on a large
trunk.
What was
she doing at the Mayo Clinic?
I can't remember.
I'm just like wondering, because like that's obviously like a very famous hospital where typically you go for like specialty illnesses or like something like that where like you see.
I don't actually know what she was doing there.
I don't know if it was that way in the 70s either, but I'm just so.
But I do know that was the last time anyone besides him says he saw her was like going into that clinic. He didn't report her disappearance for like a couple of weeks.
God, John.
And then they are like, we're going to give you a lie detector test. And he keeps like failing the lie detector test in terms of the question of like, do you know what happened to her? Obviously, I don't care about that. We don't care about lie detector tests. Not. But I'm more telling you that as like the way the investigators felt, I'm sure, was this guy had something to do with it. And then he like burnt all these journals of hers as well. So did her brother, though. I think her brother was a part of burning those journals. And the whole thing about the journals is she would do a thing where she was like letting psychic forces guide her hand. She was like a little bit into spiritualism, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so I think they did it because it really felt personal. And he said if anything ever happened to her, she asked that these be destroyed. So I destroyed them. We don't know if that's the case. We just don't fucking know. But 2 years after she vanishes, and they're obviously looking at John Matlick. They even looked at her brother because he inherited all this money. But he also had a huge reward for, do you know what happened to my sister? And it really doesn't look like it was him at all.
But that's a good cover-up if you have a huge reward for what happened to your sister.
And maybe
you
made John Matlick do it. I don't know. I don't fucking know. But in 1979, 2 years later, there is a message that gets spray painted near her old estate. And it says, Richard Bailey knows where Brock's body is. Now, Richard Bailey is a dude that's in the horse world that was going after her. Mm-hmm. Like, they were in a relationship. And when they bring him in for questioning, he takes the fifth, so they don't really learn anything. But what it sounds like is that they had a tight relationship that suddenly got cut off. And later, when they look into who this guy is, he took out a bunch of Lonely Hearts ads and was like, I love dancing. I love exercising. I love long walks. And I just like, I'm super family oriented. And he was dating all these rich widows and divorcees.
Divorcees or divorcees, Quinn?
Divorcees.
I'm asking.
And basically, the order of operations is that they were like having the time of their lives New Year's Eve. And then early in 1977, he got her to make some shoddy horse investments. What he basically did is they would bring her to these horses and be like, these are worth so much money. And she'd put in a bunch of money. And he'd be like, yeah, they're worth a lot. And then later he'd be like, come check out these horses. But then she left really fast that second time, where people are like, something happened where she was on to him. Because then he's telling her, I have this horse guy. Let me see what he'd charge you to train these horses. And the guy's like, oh, you should pay like $50,000 to get the horses trained. And then she brings in her own guy and he's like, no, you shouldn't bring anybody in to train these horses. It's like a wasted investment. So she's freaks out and goes to him. Like, she basically realizes, like, you sold me shit horses. Mm-hmm. You had these people lying about like what I was buying. And she goes and is like, I'm going to blow this up. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to tell everybody you did this. I'm going to go to the district attorney's office. And then she goes to a friend and is like, you'll never believe it. That guy I'm seeing, Bailey, he sold me these fucking like bunk horses. And she's like, well, I know. Her friend's like, well, I know state prosecutors. Do you want their number? And she's like, yeah, I want to go visit their office right after I go to the Mayo Clinic. So the timeline
adds up.
So when they're looking at this guy, they're like, what's his game? And they like look into his con game, his history. And basically,
Bailey, such like an Americana name, totally. Too. It's like,
and there was like three cons that seemed to be his classics. He would say his money was tied up and he found a horse, though, that was like this really good investment opportunity. And then he'd use the horse's collateral, and he'd get a loan from the victim and he'd never repay the victim. Mm-hmm. But then if he defaulted on the loan, they're just stuck with this fucking horse and all the boarding bills for the horse. The other thing he would do is be like, let's go into a partnership together.
God, using a live animal as collateral is
gets so
dark. So
much worse. So he would go in with a buddy and he'd be like, let's go to this guy whose horse is for sale. And it's such a good deal. You know what? I'm going to split it with you because this horse is going to make us so much money. Let's split it. Let's each put in however much. And he'd match it. But then as soon as the woman walks away,
his friend tears up
his check and they split hers. And obviously the horse is worth nothing. Basically, he does all kinds of scams like this. And he gets charged eventually with fleecing her and a bunch of other ladies because this was just his pattern. But when they're doing the probe on this, they're talking to a bunch of different people in this shitty horse mafia world in Chicago. They basically unlock the saddest, grossest, weirdest world where there's all these riders and trainers and people that are charged with insurance fraud schemes where they were like paying to insure horses and then like killing them or breaking their legs. And doing like terrible things to
maim the horses
to collect the insurance.
It's like,
on them.
It's giving me also like, remember in Crime of a Lifetime we covered the horse girl episode? Like, that's the same area.
It's so dark, but like they were like electrocuting horses, breaking their legs with sledgehammers and crowbars. Like,
horrible.
They like would light hay on fire in a barn and like these horses would burn alive. It's so sad. And it was so dense, the amount of this sort of thing that was happening. There was just guys that were basically horse killers, like that you'd hire a hit. You'd be like, that's a horse hitman. Like, I can like pay him to come kill my horse or like my friend's horse or...
Jeez.
Can you imagine?
No.
So this is when they also start getting into the connections to this guy, Silas Jane. Like I said, he's like the godfather. He's like the main guy. And he's a really bad guy. In his history, he has a rape conviction. And he has... I could do a whole episode on him plotting to kill his brother, George. He and his brother, George, were rivals in this world. And I cannot get into it, but I can tell you, because it's like too much, but I can tell you the number of times he said he was going to kill his brother and tried to kill his brother is the longest list in the world. And he would do things like plant all kinds of different bombs, try to shoot him through his work office window. He one time rigged his car with dynamite and the guy sent his like secretary to move his car and she blew up. So blood is all over this guy's hands. And Jesus. And eventually he did kill his brother. He got somebody to kill his brother. They killed him when he was at home celebrating his son's 16th birthday.
Jesus.
They shot him through the basement window when he was dealing a bridge hand to his family members. I mean, cold-blooded shit. And this is his brother. So he's darkness and like very scary. But he's been dead for years when they start going through this case stuff. But he was in the same circles as Richard, looking at his past, diving into Silas Jane's past. They're like, oh, he was also questioned in 1955, of course, because that was his stable was near where the boys' bodies were found.
Who, Silas or
Silas.
Oh,
Silas's
wow.
stables yeah. that he owned. He owned a lot of things, but yes. But there was a man that worked at those stables named Kenneth Hansen, who was 22.
If this is
fucking
now
in his
John,
60s.
If this is John, what's the houseman's name?
Matlick.
If this is John Matlick, I'll scream.
Oh, well, just hold your horses.
I just like wanted to guess. Like it's a fun whodunit because we're
is.
Full circle.
There's so many characters. That's why I tried to limit the storytelling because it's kind of wild.
So there's a 20-year-old that works at John Silas's.
There was a 22-year-old that worked near those stables or at those stables, depending on who you ask. Definitely an associate of Silas Jane. Mm-hmm. Definitely a ne'er good, what do you call him? A ne'er-do-well. Kenneth Hansen. He was 22 at the time those boys died.
My uncle's name was Ken Hansen.
It's not him. I looked into
it. Thank you.
I made sure he wasn't related to
you. Thank
you
so much.
I always do that with these stories.
Oh, phew.
Yeah. So while they're doing this and they're like, this roster is getting enormous of looking into all these different people, but they're trying to, I imagine they've got their character board and they're drawing like, you know, lines with yarn and whatnot. And then an informant comes forward named William Red Wimette. And he is a Chicago pornographer. And he's like, oh, Kenny Hansen, he told me that he murdered those boys.
That's a New York accent. I want full Chicago.
Oh,
Chicago.
Kenny Hansen, he told me he murdered those boys.
Kenny Hansen, oh, he told me he murdered those boys.
I don't know. That's better.
Is that it?
He told me he murdered those boys. They find a lot of witnesses that are like, yeah, sure. Years ago, he was drunk and told me the same. They look into his history and they're like, you're not a great guy. In 1970, you're not.
They go, you know what? He's not a good guy. He's not a good guy.
Well, in 1970, he supposedly lit a fire that killed 36 horses. And it was just to take out a competitor's stable. And so they're like, oh, now that we think about it, now that we're thinking about him in terms of being an arsonist, we also remember that we were talking years ago about exhuming those boys' bodies for evidence. And right when we said we were going to do it, there was a fire at his barn. Did he do it because there was something there that he was trying to destroy evidence-wise? And then they exhumed the boys and they did find hay in their lungs. So it's like they are tied somehow to being in one of these nearby.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. They end up bringing him to trial. And he knows it's coming. Like he's asking neighbors, are there police watching my house? And he packed a suitcase to leave town, but they bust him. They arrest him in August in 1994. She was killed. She went missing in 1977. Just so you're starting to get like a clear picture.
Well, also the boy. So wait.
1955.
But he was arrested for her?
He was arrested for them.
Thank you.
But
for
it
the boys.
Was her. She's like, that's why I was saying it's so circuitous. Basically, by looking into what happened to Helen, they start to think they can answer what happened to those boys. It wasn't, they never would have thought that was the path that they were walking on.
Yeah.
But somehow it is.
Wow.
And
that is some good police work of just leaving your mind open mm-hmm. and allowing the evidence to come and not having a pre-existing
yeah, and
narrative.
I think because it's local, it's like everyone, again, those boys were everything. So everybody knew yeah. and everybody always had it on the brain. But they bring him to trial. At this point, he's in his 60s. He's married. He has a couple of kids. And he's like, I am innocent. And his son, who was born after those little boys died, of course, tells reporters, whoever would have done a crime like this would have to have been a monster, and that's not my father. During his trial, they paint a picture of, like, these were kids that were hitchhiking. They got picked up by him. He took him to the stable where he worked, the Idol stable, and he sexually abused at least one of them, strangled all of them, and then 7 months later, he burnt down these stables to get rid of all the evidence when he knew we were going to exhume them. A lot of witnesses come forward in this trial and say, yeah, he picked up underage boys hitchhiking. Yes, he would try to get them work at the stable. He'd try to have sex with them. There was a young boy that says, I walked in on this guy when I was a kid and he was performing oral sex on a 15-year-old. And he said, if I told anyone, I'd end up like those boys in the forest. Doesn't really prove anything. Some of the characters that come forward, Roger Spry is one. He says that when he was 11 or 12, he started living with Hansen's family and that Hansen tried to abuse him. He mm-hmm. rebuffed it. And then he was made to sleep outside in a dog kennel. And that finally he stopped pushing away and Hansen would perform oral sex on him. Then they had a sexual relationship that lasted till he was 18. And one thing about the oral allegations is that, again, these boys were naked. We don't know if anything happened to them. We wouldn't know if it was oral in nature. So he says that as when he got older, Hansen would basically be like, would tell him things and ended up telling him that he picked up three boys that were hitchhiking once and took them to the barn and started having sex with one or both of the younger ones. The other one walked in. They said he was going to get in trouble or threatened to report him, and he didn't know what to do, so he did kill them. There's a guy that comes forward that was 21 at the time and says that he had a consensual sexual relationship with Kenneth. He says that he admitted to him, too, that he had killed those boys a few weeks afterwards and that his dad, this guy, Herb Hollins, was a Chicago police officer, and he didn't tell him and he didn't tell anybody because he was so scared of getting that it would get out that he was homosexual. So he just didn't tell anybody.
Oh my God.
And he was afraid also of being killed because he knew how dangerous Kenneth Hansen was. So then there's all these people that come forward and go, he didn't work at the barn during those years and I never saw him there. Or somebody saying, like, I remember when that spry kid lived there. I'd come early in the morning for work. That kid did not sleep in a fucking dog kennel. I never saw him in a dog kennel. Then they bring this guy forward, Dan Strong, who he served with, who the defendant served with in the military. And he says he and his wife, Beverly, were visiting me when this crime was committed. They were visiting me in Texas. And they show all these pictures of the trip. They can't date the pictures, so it doesn't hold up really. And he's like, to the best of my knowledge, it did happen during that time, but I don't know the exact dates. The defense sort of botches the trial in that they should have probably just focused on, you don't have enough proof. because there's no forensic evidence. Of course, it's a very old case.
It's all circumstantial.
But they do weird things like be like, you know what? It was John Wayne Gacy. And everyone's like, John Wayne Gacy was 13 at the time. He was the same age as all these little boys that got killed. And they're like, yes, but that's when you got a taste for it. And it's like a little like, let's relax. Like, you don't need to find like this whole other narrative.
They should have just pulled a Larry Posner and been like, just dispute the evidence that they have.
Just not even deal with what you
have.
But
I'm sure it sounds like in the 90s too. I mean, like, obviously having all these men come forward and talk, like, the feelings against gay men, I'm sure didn't help in a jury trial.
This is
as well.
Huge. And
like,
that's what that's part of the appeal, because he will get convicted, but he'll appeal it and he'll say, this trial, so much of this trial was about me being gay. So much of this trial was that I had a penchant for underage boys. All of it's true. I never denied picking up hitchhikers. I never denied having sex illegally with kids. But that's the wrong thing to prosecute. You don't get to prosecute someone for murder just because they're a child molester.
Right.
You have to stick to the... Right. It's like, and of it's course like we all just want the bad guys in the jails. But it's like, that's not... We can't muddy the system. That's very dangerous.
Totally, totally. But he was on trial. He was basically on trial for this murder, but he was convicted because he was a pedophile.
Well, yes. And of course, the defense will make it say the same with a gentler touch and say, because he was homosexual. He is convicted. He's sentenced to 200 years. And you got to look at it and say, why? Secondhand testimony of people that were, for the most part, had reasons to hate him. Mm-hmm. We're not reliable narrators. We're like not trustworthy. We're known liars. Like a lot of them were. And it just brings up this question of, can you even have a fair trial that many years later without anything but circumstantial evidence?
Exactly. Because DNA comes out in the late 80s, early 90s. But I don't know if they're even able to have any connection.
They don't.
At that point. Of course, because they don't. You know, it's in the 50s that this crime happened. That there's no way to even forensically connect the two.
So in 2000, they're like, we probably, like, some of the things we allowed into this trial maybe shouldn't have been. So they're gonna do a retrial. They do. He's convicted again with like a similar sentence situation. And in 2007, he's waiting for another appeal on that, and he dies in prison. Mm-hmm. And he's 74 years old. The closure on Helen's case, because we kind of hopped away from that and I want to circle back, is that her body was never, ever found.
Yeah.
They had some people like say they knew what happened that are also not trustworthy people, but they're like, we think her remains might have been dissolved like in a chemical vat.
Yeah.
Or in a furnace. And there, and the, it was the Chicago outfit behind it. And then it had to do with her threatening to expose because it wasn't just Richard.
If she were to expose Richard, she would expose the entire thing.
And there was a lot of powerful people, and way I'm more
sure,
powerful
yeah,
than
and
Richard.
And I'm sure that the prosecutor, too, would have gotten, you know, if they wanted to prosecute, I mean, they could have taken it and just run with it.
Well,
and shut down
the
mafia.
The only person they can point to is with, they feel, evidence is Richard Bailey. And they do. And he gets sentenced to 30 years on, and I quote, the preponderance of evidence that he was the killer. Mm. He was released in July of 2019.
Don't come for me, Richard Bailey.
89 years old at the time. Served his time. Matlick, never charged.
That guy knows.
And it doesn't sit well. He is also dead. He died in 2011 at a nursing home. And the brother says, I think it was Matlick.
Wait, Matlick's brother says it was Matlick?
No, no, her brother, Helen's brother.
Oh, right.
Helen's brother is like, I think it was Matlick.
And I think he got money from it.
And he said, and not only that, I don't think Richard Bailey had anything to do with it. I don't think any of those, the mafia guys, the racketeer guys, I don't think it was related.
Do you think that Kenneth Hansen killed the boys?
I don't know how he could have defended himself from what they were presenting in trial 40 years later. It doesn't seem like a very fair trial to me.
But that doesn't necessarily mean he didn't do it.
But also there was a guy that confessed to those murders that they didn't even bring that to the trial. Like there were certain things that, which again, like false confession, it doesn't
necessarily mean it happened. I mean, listen, I do think that Kenneth Hansen belonged in jail because he was clearly taking advantage of
children. One thing that confuses me a lot is that it doesn't take a negligible amount of time to choke someone. And the idea
three boys
that he goes, oh, I'm going to get caught. He's like 5'6", kind of skinny. You know, not like much bigger. He wasn't like a huge presence.
The cause of death of the boys, was it strangulation?
They're all strangled. So then you go, what?
How?
How? It just seemed, it seems like it had been really tricky. And a lot of people think that he had a big brother, Curtis Hansen. And a lot of them think that he maybe was there that night and maybe was party to this and that they did it together. But like the other thing is like they uncovered all sorts of things. They say there was a pedophile ring on the Northwest side and that there was a guy named Charles Dalquist who was already under indictment for molesting a kid in that exact forest. And he could have done it.
These so poor kids.
It just...
The poor families. Like that's just... Oh my God.
So we... Do I think he did it? I don't know, but I'll tell you one thing that's pretty interesting is that in an article I read that came out exactly a year ago, November 2022, pretty mm-hmm. much, it was about the Grimes sisters. And it was saying it's been 60 years and they really always thought that the Grimes sisters were related to these three boys' death, that it was the same person, and that they realized they're able to prove that Hansen was at the Brighton Theater at the same time those girls were, the same night, and that their bodies were found on property that he had leased for pasturing horses.
Is it a coincidence?
And here's the thing that's like a total buzzkill in this, and maybe this will sound familiar from when you did it. They had a semen sample from Barbara. They lost it.
Yeah.
Hansen's DNA is in the database now because of all this, but they can't compare it because they lost her sample and it just lost it. And
jeez,
it's on the table right now, or at least it was when this article was written, that a lot of people were like, we got to exhume them. We got to exhume them to try to solve this because now we have some kind of DNA to test against their bodies, which is Hansen's.
The question is do you disrupt the bodies? And I'm actually the story we're going to I'm going to tell a truly darkly creepily story about bodies, but that's
well, I'm done. I just want to add, I would say like it's all that's very like
it's like you want it to, it's thought provoking and you want it to be tied up. You want to put the bow on it. I don't have a bow to put on this.
I'm going to give you the best bow I can, which is that there was so much sadness in this story.
And there was so much crime. And I don't know if the people went to jail for the crimes that they committed.
Everybody should have been in jail.
Exactly.
They should have just been like, let's all just go to jail. You're all acting poorly.
I just want there to be justice for those boys. And if this is the closest I can get to justice, but I don't know, you know.
Yeah. I know that the animal violence is really, really hard for some people to stomach. And I did want to put this little gift out there that when Helen was declared dead and she had no idea what was going to happen to her and she had no idea who she was going to get involved with, and it was these kinds of people. Mm-hmm. But very ironically, she had left an enormous chunk of her estate to animal rights causes. So
just so sad because too is that you can say, like, I'm sure Richard Bailey saw that and preyed upon it, you know, like I'm sure like that feeling of, you know, she was this heiress who lost her husband. She had this candy fortune and she just wanted to, like, preying on people's empathy is just so gross. Thank you for telling that story.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the story I'm telling is not similar at all. But there might be some crossover.
We always look for it.
We always look for it. We always love to see it. Okay. So I got this information from People Inside Edition.
I didn't say my sources. Oh my God. Thank God you said something. I got to go back in time and tell you that I got my sources from New York Times, LA Times, WGN-TV, Court of Appeals, The People versus Hansen, New City, Case Law, People versus Hansen, UPI, People, ABC, and United States versus Bailey.
Hot. Okay, I am got my sources from, and you're gonna just gonna copy and paste that into a previous.
Yeah, because I'm so profesh.
Do you know how to do that? You just cut the chunk, copy, and then paste it, and you can put it elsewhere.
Yeah. Do that.
Okay. I got this information from People, Inside Edition, New York Times, New York Post, CBS, Press Democrat, Cron Foreign, NBC. I'm going to be talking about Katie Sorensen. Do you know about her?
No.
Katie Sorensen, I always just like assume you might know and you might have heard of her.
I often know things and I often do not.
You often know things and that's sort of something like a 50-50. It's a 50-50. Katie Sorensen, she's a momfluencer from California.
Sweet.
And her handle is Motherhood Essentials.
How essential.
And she has two kids. She has a one-year-old daughter and a four-year-old son. And a little bit about like her mom influencer vibe is like, I would say I didn't follow her because she's been deactivated. I would say like from what I understand, she was like peddling some conspiracy theories. Mm. Some might say she might have been a little bit too close to QAnon for comfort.
Okay.
So like really doesn't.
Giving me like Lori Vallow vibes.
Lori Vallow, but like.
She believed in demons.
I don't know if it's demons, but she does believe that like a lot of fear-based content is mm-hmm. sort of like what I'm gleaning from it. So it is December 7th, 2020. She is at Michael's Craft Store because of course she is. I mean, listen, we prefer Michael's. We love Michael's.
I would imagine
she's a Hobby Lobby girl, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what you know the vibe?
Sure do.
You know? But she's at Michael's. She's at the craft store in Petaluma, California, which is about 40 miles north of San Francisco. And she's with her two kids and they're shopping. And she notices she's being followed by a Latino couple. And they've made comments to her about her kids. And so she does her shopping. She pays for it. She goes outside and she's loading her kids in the car from the stroller. And she claims that the couple approached her and like tried to reach into the stroller and tried to like kidnap her kids. So she sees this happening. She screams for help. They leave. She's quoted as saying, you know, they didn't necessarily look clean cut. They gave her the heebie-jeebies and that she was paralyzed with fear. So right after this trip to Michael's, she calls the police and she's like, hey, I have to tell you what happened. My kids almost got kidnapped. It was really scary. Can I come in? They're like, come in, make a statement. She goes in and makes a statement. She writes the report down. She talks to, I think, an officer and a dispatch. And about a week later, she gets on her Instagram because you know what? Take your broken heart and turn it into art. Am I right?
Yeah.
Am I right?
You're right. So when you're right, you're right.
She has 57,000 followers on her Instagram and she tells this harrowing tale of what I just told you. She says, my children were the targets of an attempted kidnapping. I want to share that story with you in an effort as to what signs to look for and to encourage parents to be more aware of their surroundings and what is going on around them.
And then she just has a guide on how to racially profile people.
Yes. Oh my God. If they look different from you, for sure it's them. They're probably trying to attack you. Do you know what I mean?
Super healthy. Thank God for people like you, you fucking asshole.
This video, Quinn, is viewed over 4 million times. It launches her little mommy essentials, mother essentials, motherhood essentials Instagram. Mm-hmm. And it like she gets a bunch of views, a bunch of people start supporting her. She gets a couple of news outlets who want to speak to her. And once this video comes out and the police obviously start to sort of piece this together and look at this video, they notice that she had some discrepancies between the report and the video.
Wait, so she's actually, what's her name that faked her own kidnapping? Sherry Papini. She's Sherry Papini. I will say vibes Sherry of Papini. I got kidnapped by.
This is Sherry Papini. In fact, like a lot of the articles were like, more about it. Sherry Papini.
Yep.
So what happens is obviously people start sharing. Fear spreads like wildfire. And she becomes like someone who is protecting kids and is just like doing it out of the goodness of her heart. You know, she wants to make sure parents know what to look out for.
Mm-hmm.
So the police are looking like, this is really weird. They interview her a week later and they show her some surveillance footage from the Michaels that day that they had acquired. And she's able to identify the Latino couple that followed her, that she claims is them. So she identifies this couple as the perpetrator. Local media outlets invite her on. She starts talking to a bunch of people. She ends up revealing the couple that followed her around.
Revealing, like,
who they were.
Saying their names.
I think so. It's a little unclear, but
somehow
I think,
indicating their identity.
Yes. And the internet being the internet, they found them. The police are obviously looking at the surveillance footage of the people that she had indicted in her report, or the people that she had accused of the report. And when the police start looking at the video, like, they didn't even come in contact with her.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't even close.
Do they have it of the parking lot? Is her whole thing like, you didn't see it happen, it happened out here?
I don't know what her whole thing is, but she has a story and she is sticking to it, my guy. So the police interview the couple and they deny all the allegations.
Yeah.
The police essentially hear the allegations. They look at the video and they're like, this investigation is closed. This is a fake reporting that she did. The couple in question is Sadie and Eddie Martinez. And what happened is they had been, there had been photos of them. They had been maligned. She had allured, she had like, I don't know if she revealed their name. I don't know if she revealed their name, to be honest, but I think she alluded to them. And I think people were able to find them, so much so that the two of them ended up having a press conference with their attorney where they were like, hi, we were accused of this and it's not us. And they even said they were just guilty of shopping while brown. Mm-hmm. Is what they said. In fact, their story is they were at Michael's that day because they were shopping for Christmas decorations. They bought a baby Jesus for their nativity scene. That's like what they were doing that day. And frankly, they didn't need any more babies. Okay, they had the most famous baby in their possession. I don't think they wanted this crazy lady's 1-year-old and 4-year-old kid. They weren't interested.
No, and it's like outlandish to think that that's what happened.
The fact, too, is that they didn't have any interaction with her, not once during their trip to Michael's. But once their names got out, it was like they couldn't put the lid back on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was hell for them. They already, you know, they expressed how challenging it was to be a Latin family in a wholly white community. And that even though the story was false and the investigation was dropped, this couple was harassed relentlessly. They were harassed online. Their landlord got wind of it and essentially evicted them. They found a reason to evict them from their homes.
Mm-hmm.
They were racially profiled. And all of this comes to a culmination. So this accusation happens in December 2020. And less than a year later, Katie Sorensen is charged with 3 misdemeanor counts of making a false report of a crime.
Good.
The initial videos she posted on her stupid Instagram have been deleted, but she does have supporters still who believe her because she never got out and said, I was wrong, this happened.
She never apologized.
She never tried to get in front of it. She just let the narrative go. And it's like
these people don't have any legal recourse against her.
Because
can't they sue her?
But I don't know if she necessarily outed them herself. She like alluded to them. I don't think this was their recourse. Their recourse was that she could be charged for making a false statement.
Yeah.
Her supporters claim that she was just trying to protect her kids, and they even created websites to support her in this trial. Like, that's how this lie got out of hand.
Well, that's how much people want the story to be true.
People wanted the story to be true. People are fear-mongering. And, like, again, she's coming from a place that's like, I just want to protect everyone. Mm. And it's like, no, you don't.
She's coming from a very racist place.
A very racist place. Attention. An opportunistic, disgusting clickbait that didn't happen in this poor couple whose life was turned upside down from her disgusting accusations. So she, at one point while she was awaiting trial, she tried to secure diversions, which is a process that dismisses misdemeanor charges if a defendant meets the terms and conditions presented to the court. So the judge who was presiding over this case denied this twice. And the reason this judge denied this twice is because she said that Katie never took responsibility for her actions or even explained why she claimed kidnapping in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, I don't think they could have charged her based on what she said online, because I think there's a protection of free speech.
Yeah.
I think she could have said that was my experience. Mm-hmm. And so who are you to arbitrate that? And like, what can of worms would that open? So the only thing they could do was like, you spoke to officers of the law and you lied. Prosecutors maintain that she was trying to financially benefit from the content. Makes sense. She has a page and it drove clicks and interest. They also said that they also talked about her involvement and engagement in QAnon conspiracy theories, which center on kidnapping and pedophiles, right? So it's like this idea, this input that she's having, this stuff that she's reposting, and then it, like, she has a way that she could justify that it happened to her, and like, she's striking while the iron is hot. Her claims is that she just misinterpreted the events of December 7th.
That is so shitty.
Like, she doesn't ever fully come out and say, I lied, that's not what happened, I'm sorry. In April of 2023, she was convicted of one single count of knowingly making a false report of a crime. The other two charges were dropped because one of them was a statement made to a dispatcher and the other was to an officer, I think the initial one before she made the formal report. So they tried to charge her with that. But I'm curious if they're like, they never asked, are you telling the truth or something? I'm sure there was like a loophole that got her out of it, but she was convicted on one misdemeanor account. She faced up to 6 months in jail, but she was sentenced to 90 days in jail, with 60 of the 90 days are eligible to be served as a work release program. She never addressed the court. Not an apology, nothing. But Sadie did. But Sadie did, the wife of this couple. She said that a heartfelt apology could have prevented it from getting to this point. It didn't have to be like this, is what she said. And it's just wild to me that this woman has never admitted to what she did. Officials even say she's never taken responsibility for her actions. The judge on the case, Judge Laura Passaglia, she said that Katie acted with selfishness and maliciousness. When she was convicted, in addition to the 90 days, 60 of which is on work release, which I'm like, eye roll. It doesn't feel like enough to me. But you know what? That's why I'm not a judge. But like, the fact, like, these people like lost their home. These people's lives were turned upside down. And there's people out there that still think that they were guilty of something that they never did. She was also placed in a year-long informal probation, which means she is banned from using any and all social media. And she also has to submit to warrantless searches and seizures. And she has to complete a 4-hour impact bias training. How inconvenient.
How 4 inconvenient. Hours.
Do you think that's going to deprogram her from QAnon? Is my question for you. Do you think it's going to work?
I just can't believe she got off so easy.
So easy. I mean, she also has fines. But I think, like, to me, what was so clear about this case.
She should be banned from Michael's forever. And Hobby Lobby. No craft stores for you.
There should be no craft stores at all. Joanne Fabrics, good luck.
You're running around taking joy from people. We're going to take that joy right back.
Her poor kids, too. Oh, like, her God. Poor fucking horrible. Kids.
Horrible.
They, like, lost their
They're, like,
their
little pawns in this fucking make-believe game.
Yes, yeah, and horrible. She's, like, a blonde white lady.
Mm-hmm. Of course she is.
Which, let's, you know, I am, too. But I hope I'm not that blonde white lady. Like, she's the definition of a fucking Karen. Obviously, Sadie and Eddie Martinez, the couple, they were interviewed and they were like, we think it should have been tried as a hate crime, essentially. It's like, why wasn't it? And the defense.
That's what it is.
The defense to this had said that, well, in the video, she also sort of like pointed to a suspicious white person that she encountered. So it wasn't racist. Vile. Absolute vile. When the verdict was read, Eddie, he kissed his wife's hand. And I think this is how you know they're the bigger, better people in this situation, because he also spoke to a news outlet and he said, you know, he empathized with Katie, because being a parent, to be away from your kids that long, it's tough. I feel bad, he said. He added that hopefully this might teach her a lesson of seeing other sides of life, experiencing that, hearing that, going through it. It might wake her up and help her see the light.
Oh, we hope so, Eddie, but we don't think so.
I am
we
not.
We think she's human garbage for life.
Sadie is just hopes that she feels some sort of remorse. And she said, when you make a mistake, own it. Doubling down didn't do anything but hurt her even more. And that's exactly what she did. She doubled down. And it was so gross when she was convicted. Like, the tears that she cried was so gross. Where it was like, grow up. Grow up.
I hate it.
Yeah, so do I.
What a story. What a fucking
A little short
monster.
But sweet story after your long one.
What an absolute monster.
But I think what's crazy to me again is, like, what blew my mind is I think she was falling on the sword in this one, which was, this is what was confusing to me, is I'm sure her defense team was like, you should issue an apology. You should, even if you don't feel it, you should issue an apology. And I'm wondering if she was like, no, I'm not going to, because I'd rather have this, or maybe she believed it in some way, or she'd rather have this like sort of vague.
Well, by not issuing an apology, she also kept a lot of those people who were her supporters being like, maybe it is true.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I think, and
which
that's
is the crime. That's a double crime, you know?
Yeah, it's I think that's what's insidious about it. By not saying anything,
she's continuing to perpetrate the lie.
Yeah, and so it's like, yeah, they can judge her for making a false statement, but like, what is truth? What is a lie? Especially among QAnon conspiracy theorists. I thought that was what was interesting to me about this case was like, and that came up not in a ton of research, that she was like peddling QAnon conspiracies, but this idea of like falling on the sword and like trying to be a martyr for this cause. And like, there are very real life consequences to this lovely couple who showed her nothing but empathy and compassion. It's just like, it's so grotesque to me, but it's like, it reminds me of sort of like the political world that we're in at the moment, which is you have people who are lying, and I, it's, you know, Trump to me, it's the Trump of it all. It's like, does he believe the lie or is he using it to self-serve? Like, I don't know. I don't
always
know the difference.
Self-serve, I think.
It's always, but it can be both, right? So like, I don't know if she
can say it so much you're confused about what you believe in.
Totally. Like I genuinely, that is something I'm so curious about. And I think like, can you say a lie enough times where it is true in your mind? Yeah, I guess. But like the real life consequences
but
of
there
this.
Is that it's threat like, of deciding to tell the lie in the first place.
Yes.
So it's,
but it's like, the election. It's like, I mean, again, I don't want to get, I mean, we can get into it if you want, but like with the election deniers, right? The big lie, as it's been quoted, is like, do you think Trump really believes that the election was stolen?
No.
You don't think?
No, I don't at all think. And I think I could be totally wrong about this, but I think he's told people that. Like, I think it's...
I think he believes it. I think he genuinely believes
Interesting.
It.
Interesting. Let's ask him.
Coming out of the closet.
Coming out of the podcast closet.
Donald Trump. Fuck you.
How did you fit in there? Oh, I guess your hands are really small.
Anyway. Well, what's a lie? What's truth?
What's a lie and what's truth? Write in and tell us.
Write in and tell us.
We'll see you next week.
We'll see you next week.
With another lie and a truth. Or maybe two truths or maybe a lie.
Or maybe two lies.
And
or maybe
no
all lies.
Truths.
Goodbye.
Or is it?
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Is it better to max out your 401k or put more in a brokerage account? Does buying a home make financial sense in today's market? Should you use extra cash to pay off debt or invest? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing and budgeting strategies to help you build wealth and navigate major financial decisions. Make smarter money moves. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.